Oh, hello everybody. Let me start by thanking Michelle for inviting me here. It's my second time at the perimeter. I've been here maybe 2005 or 6 for a CIFAR meeting that I really enjoyed. In my talk today, I'll describe our experimental endeavors to look at the phenomenon of quantum criticality in two insulating quantum magnets, where we observe quite a rich structure of the excitations and also some novel phases close to quantum criticality that I'll describe in some detail. Can everybody hear? Yeah? So the first system I will talk about, it's a realization of a one-dimensional Ising magnet in transverse field. For this work, my main collaborator has been Alan Tennant from Berlin, where part of the experiments have been done. Most of the work that I'll show today, however, is experiments done at the ISIS pulse neutron source in the UK. I will also show measurements of crystal field excitations, which give us information about relevant anisotropies in this material. And these were part of the PhD thesis of two of my students, Lucian Pascut, who's now at Rutgers, and Elisa Wheeler at the ILL. And crystals were grown in Oxford by Prabhakaran. And more recent work, where we've looked at the dispersion close to criticality, was done by Ibelisse Cabrera and Jordan Thompson in my group in Oxford. Jordan is a former alumni of University of Waterloo. If there is time, I'll also talk about another material, also based on cobalt, but this time cobalt has easy plane anisotropy. This was part of the PhD thesis of Lucian. And also, this system shows some novel spin density wave phase close to a critical point. So I'll start with a brief introduction to the concept of quantum phase transitions and why experimentally we're interested in exploring physics close to such points in a parameter space. And then I'll show realization of this type of physics in two materials, an Ising chain in transverse field, and a planar XXZ plane chain system in transverse field. So the idea of quantum phase transition refers to a transition that happens at zero temperature as a function of some tuning parameter. So imagine that we have two neighboring phases, phase one and phase two, that we can tune between them at zero temperature by, say, tuning the magnetic field or pressure or doping concentration. And a simple example of this would be a type 1 superconductor, which has a superconducting phase at zero and low field, but that is suppressed by sufficiently strong fields, and then we end up with a normal phase. In this particular case, this transition is first order, and what I will focus today on is examples of quantum phase transitions where the transition actually is continuous. And the reason we're interested in this is that physics is richer, as in the presence of a continuous transition, then fluctuations are much more important in mediating the transition. And what I'll talk about is situations where the quantum phase transition is actually the endpoint of a line of finite temperature phase transitions that's suppressed all the way up to zero by a tuning parameter, which in this case is magnetic field. So one of the reasons this is interesting is because it's, the transition is mediated by quantum fluctuations, so a direct manifestation of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle on a macroscopic scale. And it's not only the critical point that has these strong fluctuations, but a large part of the phase diagram surrounding it is believed to be influenced by the correlations at the critical point. So experimentally, there are many interesting questions to address. In particular, one may want to design experiments to look in detail at and identify the microscopic mechanism of the transition. As I mentioned, quantum fluctuations are important in mediating this transition. So can one design experiments to directly observe how quantum fluctuations become very strong here and they mediate the transition? Another important aspect is the fact that these two neighboring phases may have very different internal structures, correlations, and also quasi-particles, different quantum numbers in principle. So it's a very non-trivial question how these quasi-particles of very different quantum nature can transform into one another continuously at the critical point. The other question is, can one understand the physics, so the excitation spectrum around the critical point, based on a minimal model that just involves symmetries and other fundamental properties of the system? So can one see universality in the spectrum of excitations around the critical point? And ultimately, also, what's the role of finite temperatures? And this region here is very interesting as an interplay of thermal quantum fluctuations. So I'll discuss several of these aspects experimentally today. So canonical model to look at phase transitions in magnetism is the Ising model, where only the Z spin components interact. And this was solved by a tour de force by Onsager many years ago. And he showed that below a finite temperature that's of the order of the energy scale of the interactions, the system is unstable to spontaneously order in one of the two equivalent ground states, for example, for the case of a ferromagnet, OP spins predominantly up or predominantly down. And this magnetization increases continuously from zero, reaches saturation at zero temperature. So another way to look at this is to start from low temperatures and increase thermal fluctuations, and the magnetization drops continuously to zero. And this is an example of a classically thermally driven continuous phase transition, or thermal melting of magnetic ordinates. Now, we want to do a quantum analog of this, and one way to do it is to add a transverse magnetic field to the system. This introduces quantum uncertainty in the orientation of the spin by allowing tunneling between up and down spin orientations. And when these quantum fluctuations become strong enough, they suppress the spontaneous magnetic order, again, in a continuous transition, but this time at a critical field. So we call this quantum melting of magnetic order. And today I'll describe two examples where this phenomenology happens experimentally. So for a three-dimensional system, we expect to have a finite transition temperature to spontaneous magnetic ordering at low temperatures. And then by applying a transverse field, we suppress this tendency of ordering all the way continuously down to zero temperature. And the phenomenology of this type of phase transition has been explored experimentally, and some of you may be familiar with work done on the rare earth material lithium hormone fluoride, which indeed observed this phase diagram experimentally, and also showed that because of the three-dimensionality of the system and also long range of interactions, the quasi-particles in the two phases actually were very similar in character. There were, in both cases, there were spin flips, but they only changed polarization between the two phases. So our contribution to the field was to look at a lower dimensional system, and in particular, the extreme case of one dimension, because here the physics is, because of the low dimensionality, is much richer. And in particular, excitations are expected to fundamentally change character between these two phases. In the spontaneously ordered phase, one expects to find domain wall or soliton king quasi-particles, whereas a high field, one expects to find spin flip excitation. Also, because of the low dimensionality, one expects some non-trivial scaling laws due to the conformal symmetry of the critical point. And also, effects of perturbations are much stronger in one dimension, and I will show they lead to a very rich structure of bound state. So the 1D chain is special because it has a very large degeneracy in the excitation spectrum. So there are two equivalent ground states, zero temperature, all spins up or all spins down. And a natural defect we can create in this is to flip a spin. However, that state is degenerate with a state where we flipped a whole section of the chain into the other ground state. So this is a degenerate manifold of states, and perturbations such as the transverse field mix these manifolds together and essentially allow the boundaries, these domain walls, to hop along the chain. So in a full mathematical theory, actually, it's these boundaries that become the essential degrees of freedom of the system. And they turn out to be described by so-called Jordan-Wigner fermions. And semi-classically, you can think about these domain walls as being pi twists in the ground state. So the physical picture is that the applied transverse field allows hopping, so gives kinetic energy to the solitons, and when this kinetic energy gain overcomes or matches the potential energy cost to create them in the first place, then the gap closes and the system is disordered. And upon further increasing the field, spins tend to be aligned more and more along the field, and the only excitation one can create is a spin reversal, which costs, however, a large Zeeman energy, so the gap increases again. So one expects to find a very dramatic change in the nature of quasiparticles crossing this critical point. Now, to see this type of physics, one needs an experimental system with a very good one-dimensional character in order to guarantee this degeneracy in the spectrum and to have the fundamental degrees of freedom, the one-dimensional domain walls, the soliton. One also needs a relatively low exchange interaction of order 1 millielectron volts in order to apply, in order to be able to create enough quantum fluctuations in the system to match the mean field effect. So the transition field needs to match the strength of interaction. Also, one needs a strong uniaxial anisotropy to have the Ising physics over a wide energy range. However, one doesn't need a perfect Ising system because we still need to couple to the system with a finite transverse g-factor. So it turns out that cobalt 2 plus is an ion which could, in principle, satisfy all of these interactions. It's got, it tends to have a strong easy axis and anisotropy as a result of the fact that it couples strongly to the ligand ions through the crystal. So the orbital motion of the electron is strongly affected by the negatively charged ions surrounding it, and so that tends to favor certain orientations for L, and via spin orbit coupling, the spin would also line itself up collinear to L, and this gives rise to anisotropy. And in a more formal treatment, then the energy levels are split into a set of Cramer's doublets, and the lowest one behaves as an effective spin a half because it's doublet, and Ising lie because it's the easy axis anisotropy. And here are a number of Ising systems that have been explored experimentally, and some of these were fundamental to our understanding of the experimental manifestation of 2D Ising physics. Now, a candidate that we find also to satisfy the requirement for the right energy scale is actually this oxide here, cobalt niobium oxide, where cobalt chains are naturally isolated in the crystal structure from one another by some non-magnetic, these green niobium chains. And the cobalt chains form a zigzag arrangement along the crystallographic axis. And in the low temperatures, spins order collinear along the local easier Ising direction, which is common for a given chain. And the interactions are mediated via super exchange for an oxygen. And because this bond is near 90 degrees, then the exchange is ferromagnetic and it's also very weak because it's a higher order effect via Hund's rule coupling on the oxygen. And we can also grow very large single crystals of this material, centimeter cubes, which is important for inelastic neutron scattering. So in order to characterize how good an Ising system this is, one can look at crystal field levels. And so for a cobalt ion in a cubic environment, then the sevenfold orbital degeneracy for a free ion is split into various levels with an orbital triplet the lowest. And then further monoclinic distortions split this and combined with the spin orbit coupling, which is comparable magnitude, leads to a set of six Cramer's doublets. And via neutron scattering, one can see transitions between these levels, and you can observe five peaks here indicating transitions from the ground state to the five excited doublets. And we can model this looking at symmetry allowed terms in the crystal field and spin orbit coupling, and we find that predominantly this has a uniaxial anisotropy. And in a simplified model for the exchange, one will have a Heisenberg-type interaction between the true spins. But when that is projected now only onto the lowest doublet, because that's the only relevant wave function at temperatures much lower than the energy scale to the next crystal field level, which is much higher. So if one projects the exchange onto this lowest doublet, because the strong is the axis in isotropy, one ends up with the predominant Ising interaction with a small transverse component, about 20% or so. And the G factors from here also reflect this in isotropy, and they're in good agreement with G factors from ESR measure. So what we find from here is that this system indeed has strong Ising character. Now, for a pure 1D system, of course, one expects to find an ordered phase only at zero temperature, and then a suppression of that is a function of field. However, any finite system would have 3D integer couplings, and what's expected to happen is that the ordered phase should survive up to finite temperatures. And in the system, they survive up to 3 Kelvin. So generically, we expect to find a low field, low temperatures, ordered phases that are spontaneously break symmetry, and then suppress those as function of field. So first, I'm going to show measurements just above the 3D transition temperature, but still at a temperature that's much smaller than the main energy scale of the interactions. So here, spins are strongly correlated along the chains, but the chains don't talk to each other. And then I'm going to show measurements at really low temperatures, here 40 millikelvin, where 3D effects come into play as a perturbative effect. And then I'm going to move to talk about the physics here. So neutron scattering is the right tool to explore the dynamics of the system, because neutrons scatter by flipping a spin, and they can create excitations which have a magnetic character, so some spin density, magnetic spin density component. And there's very characteristic signatures where the neutrons create a propagating spin flip excitation or some other magnetic excitation with a different spin density profile. So here's a schematic of the ICIS pulse neutron source where we did the experiment. There's a linear proton accelerator here. Protons are accelerated in the synchrotron here, and then they hit a target, and then this extracts out neutrons that are directing then to instruments out here. So here's a picture of the inelastic neutron scattering spectrum that we observe at temperatures just above the ordering transition. And the key feature here is that there's a gap in the spectrum of about 1.2 MeV, as expected for easy axis system, because you need to give some energy. There's an energy cost to take the spin away from the easy axis. But an important feature is that this is not a sharp excitation, but actually a boundary to a continuum, broad continuum of excitation. There's a sharpening of the spectrum here that I'll come back later. So if we go back to our caricature of a single chain, now neutron comes in and flips a spin, and if there are terms in the Hamiltonian that allow the propagation of these domain walls, then one should end up with two twists that move away from each other, and via conservation of energy and momentum, then the neutron can share its momentum between these two propagating excitations and also the energy. So if the dispersion of the single soliton would be this sinusoidal line here, then to create two of them, one scatters into a phase space that's characterized by this shaded area here, where the lower boundary corresponds to, where the edges correspond to extreme situations where the energy and momentum is shared. So for example, if we sit at zero momentum transfer, so create equal particles with equal momenta going left and right, there's no net momentum transfer to the system, but you have to give some energy to create the two solitons moving away from each other. So that explains this large span here.
Well, I was just wondering, is the transition from the sharp feature to the continuum, is that the abrupt nature of it in the data, is that a visualization issue, or is that a real thing?
Yeah, so no, that's a very good point. So actually here, there's two overlap data sets, and you can just see an apparent edge here where the two data sets were overlapped. So these are two different crystal orientations that are now projected along the chain direction. They merge here, but you could see there are two different ones. But you see on the other side, that's symmetric. There is no such edge. Okay? So this is our best attempt to mesh the two data sets, you know, given absorption corrections and what have you. But I think from here, we're confident that this is continuous. So if we now cool to very low temperatures, that's 40 millikelvin, we see a sharpening of overall sharpening of the spectrum. And in this continuum region here, we can see several very sharp resonances emerging out. So the physical picture here is that if this continuum corresponds to two free propagating solitrons, then this spectrum of sharp modes would correspond to pairs of them traveling together as a unit, so a bound state. And of course, we can do experiment with a sample oriented in different directions. So this is now dispersion along the chain direction. If we look perpendicular, you see there's very little dispersion. So essentially, these are one-dimensional objects. So a one-dimensional picture is sufficient to describe the physics. And so once the system is at these very low temperatures, then chains order with respect to one another to minimize the interchain couplings. And essentially, they're locked together. So if we look at this caricature here of, say, this domain wall moving, then every time it moves, it has to break a favorable bond with the neighbor. And so that costs some energy, which is proportional to the strength J prime. And if it moves further, again, another J prime, and so on. So there's a potential energy that has to be overcome, which grows linearly with the separation between the two domain walls. So this is similar to the physics of quarks, that whenever you want to separate them, the energy cost increases. So physically, once the system is ordered, there is a chain sits into a mean field of the neighbors. And every time solitons want to separate, they have to stretch a string tension, which is constant. So the potential increases linearly with the separation. And in this linearly increasing potential, then the solitons cannot escape from one another, and one only ends up with bound states. So on a more formal treatment, one can do a Schrodinger's wave equation in the center of mass of the system to look at the eigenstates of the system with kinetic energy and then a linear potential. And one finds only bound states, which occur at very specific energies related to some zeros of some geometric function. Now the sequence, the energy separation between these bound states is then dictated by a single scaling parameter, which is the spacing between the first two. And as you can see, if we match the spacing between the first two, then all the other bound states actually agree very well with this theoretical model. This is highly non-trivial agreement because you see the spacing is not regular. If I draw a straight line here, it won't go through these higher points here. So the way to think about these bound states, in a trivial way, they would correspond to the two domain walls just using some of their kinetic energy to separate from one another. And so you would expect to have one, say, when they're one site apart, two sites apart, and so on. But the true quantum mechanical problem, actually, when it's solved, shows that the first bound state, for example, corresponds to an overlap of solitons being many different sites apart, so even up to 10 sites apart in a coherent superposition. So these are very broad bound states that extend over very many sites. And these correspond to the quantization energies of the two fermion problem under the effect of a linear attractive potential. So as a function of temperature now, if we go above TC, then of course we expect the longitudinal mean field to disappear, and so solitons become free. So one has a confinement-deconfinement transition, and you can see that at 5 Kelvin, the onset of the continuum is actually at a slightly lower energy. So basically, this energy difference corresponds to the zero-point energy of the first kinetic, first bound state. So we can extend this analysis just done at zero momentum now to finite momentum by restricting ourselves to the two soliton states, as that's suggested phenomenologically by the data. So we can construct a phenomenological model working in this two soliton state basis, where there's an energy cost to create the solitons in the first place. That comes from the Ising exchange. Then in order to allow to reproduce this bandwidth, we need to allow soliton hopping, and that's an alpha mixing term that mixes the state with the state where domain walls are one side mixed to the left and right. Now, the sharpening of the spectrum up here has a very simple explanation in terms of being created by the next order term that's always present when one projects the Heisenberg exchange between spins onto the effective lowest doublet, in the sense that we also expect to have a very small interaction between the X and Y spin components. And when this is rewritten in terms of operators, corresponds to a combination of the S plus and S minus. And so when this is applied onto a state with one spin flip, you can see that it moves that state to the neighboring side. So it moves from state I to I plus 1 and I minus 1. So this kinet creates a so-called kinetic bound state. So when the two solitons are next to each other, they realize that via this term, they can more energetically hop together, and so they form a kinetic bound state. And its energy is actually higher than the energy that would be expected if they were free. It's kind of unusual, but it's a it's a well-documented type of binding that can occur due to kinetic terms. So putting all of this together, and including also the weak confinement term due to the mean field, then we can get a very good parameterization of essentially the whole ridge spectrum of the data, including the dispersion of all the phi bound states, the dispersion of the kinetic mode, the fact that when the kinetic mode overlaps with the continuum, the intensity spreads out, as you can clearly see here, very well reproduced by the data. Also, there's a bending of the kinetic bound state on its own would have a dispersion indicated by this gray line, but when it meets the continuum, it bends and intersects it tangentially, and one can also see that the data points here depart from the straight sinusoidal that will be created by a trivial model. So this calculation was done by solving, numerically diagonalizing a Hamiltonian. However, since then, there's also an analytic solution based on Bessel function, which essentially agrees exactly with this model. So this very good agreement, quantitative and qualitative, between the data and the calculation gives us confidence that this physical picture of solitons with the bound states actually captures to a remarkable quantitative level all the physics in this material. So we indeed have the degrees of freedom are solitons, and they're in the limit of very weak confinement where interchain couplings are of order 1% of the main exchange. And this is the limit where we want to be in order to probe the pure 1D physics. So in order to do experiments and apply magnetic field, because this is a ferromagnet, there's a technical challenge that if you have a bar magnet horizontally and if you apply a magnetic field vertically, obviously it will want to flip over. And so the torque effects are really strong. This is a three-bore magnetron ferromagnet, and in order to mechanically fix the material in place, we had to place it inside a solid metallic cage of copper and fix it all with screws to keep it in place. Otherwise, it flies off. A 3 Tesla flies off. So, or even lower. So if we apply a magnetic field, a relatively low field, there's some reorientation between the chains, because the field overcomes the very weak interchain couplings. But above 3 tesla, the behavior is relatively smooth. And so the dynamical correlations are characterized by this extended continuum, which broadens with increasing field. You see the bandwidth here significantly increases from 3 to 5 to 4 tesla. And this physically indicates that the applied magnetic field actually has a very strong effect on the excitations and tunes their kinetic energy, so increases the bandwidth. And that's the qualitatively expected effect, in the sense that the transverse field flips the spins at the end and gives them kinetic energy. So if we follow that up with increasing field, we observe that at some point there's a qualitative change in the spectrum. It's no longer a continuum with expanding bandwidth, but is actually dominated by a single sharp mode at low energies, which keeps on increasing with increasing field. And this changeover happens around about 5.5 tesla, where if we measure now the intensity of the magnetic graph peak, we see that it goes continuously to zero. So here is an overview of the spectrum as a function of magnetic field. So the order parameter is suppressed to zero, around about 5.5 tesla. And then the spectrum changes qualitatively from this bow tie continuum to actually being dominated by a single sharp mode, a high field, and close to a critical field. It's a continuum that spreads out over some wide range, but the system anticipates that it's going to go here. So the dominant weight is at low energy. So this is, in fact, the qualitative picture expected, in the sense that once we are in the ordered phase, there are two allowed ground states, and qualitatively, the quasiparticles are these solitons that interpolate between the two allowed ground states. And neutron scattering creates two of them at the same time. Whereas a high magnetic field, where the order is suppressed, the ground state is unique. The only excitation that can be created is a spin reversal. And that indicates that when neutrons come in, flip a spin, that creates a long-lived eigenstate that doesn't decay. So if we look closer, actually, into the continuum scattering here, we see that there is some structure. And we can clearly identify at low energies two peaks on top of some more structure that could be a continuum scattering. And so by analogy with the physics that we described in zero field, we attribute these modes to bound states of two solitons under a mean field effect, which could be due to the interchain couplings. But as opposed to zero field, where we had gapped fermions that are now bound together, in this case, the relevant perturbation is around the critical point. We're very close to a critical field where the solitons are actually expected to close the gap. So the relevant perturbation to consider in order to compare with the experiment is to add a longitudinal field. And this turns out to be exactly to be solvable, integrable, in the scaling limit. And this was done by Zamolodchikov in 1988. And this predicts a very remarkable spectrum, which, in some sense, it's analogous with the bound state we found in zero field. However, this is a strongly interacting many-body problem because solitons are gapless. So one has to, it's a multi-soliton problem that one has to solve in order to find the bound state. So what Zamolodchikov found by looking at the mathematical structure of this problem was that there's a spectrum of 8 bound states called meson, Ising mesons. And these particles are actually stable and do not decay even when they overlap with the continuum because of the special fine tuning to the critical point cancels matrix elements. And the energies of all these bound states they are related to a special mathematical structure of the theory, and they are in special ratios to one another. For example, the first two are in the golden mean, and so on. So the theoretical prediction for the excitation spectrum, if one was to tune the 1D chain at the critical point and apply a longitudinal field, one then would expect to find 8 particles and then combinations of those inform the continuum. So the dominant correlation, which actually diverges at the critical point, is ZZZ. And in this correlation, the weights have been calculated. And so the spectrum is expected to be dominated by 2 modes at low energies. And then these other higher order particles to occur on top of a continuum of 2M1 particles. So the main message here is that one expects to find a relative universal behavior that's dictated only by the symmetry of the problem and the perturbation around the critical point. So comparing this to the data, the spectrum shows 2 sharp peaks that can be identified at low energies and some more continuum scattering at high energies. And that resembles qualitatively this theoretical prediction. We can also look at the energies of these modes as a function of field, and their ratio, if we plot it as a function of field, increases and seems to touch this golden mean around about 5 tesla. So the true 3D critical field is 5.5 tesla, and once there are some weak 3D interactions, of course one expects that one needs a stronger field to overcome, to suppress the order, because you have to overcome also these additional interactions. So the 1D critical field would have to be lower, somewhat lower, than the through 3D critical field where the order disappears. And so we identify this point where we find best agreement with the E8 model as a field where the 1D chain would have been critical if there were no interchain couplings. So, of course, this measurement on its own is not sufficient to prove the E8 model. However, when taken in the context of the fact that we have fully characterized the excitation spectrum of the system in zero field and found such good agreement with all the theoretical prediction in that case, and have confirmed that the interchain couplings are really at the limit where the theory should be applied, we think that the agreement with the model is actually not accidental, but this is the regime where the theory really should be applicable. So just to understand a little bit the significance of this theoretical model, so C8 spectrum is expected to apply when the 1D chain is tuned exactly to the critical point, and then the longitudinal field acts as a perturbation around this point. And how Zamolodchko was able to solve this, he was able to find several conserved integrals of motion. And to get an idea of this, let's look at a simpler problem. For example, motion under center of forces. Now, whenever we have any continuous symmetries, one can associate with that conservation laws. For example, if the Hamiltonian is invariant under spatial rotations, then we have a conservation of the orbital angular momentum. Now, for motion under central forces, we have a conserved energy and orbital angular momentum. However, if the interaction force has a specific form, this 1 over r squared, then there's an additional vector that's conserved, the so-called Lenz vector. And the conservation of this vector is not due to any conventional rotation in space-time, but it's actually due to some hidden symmetry if one was to describe this in an extended mathematical space. So what Zamolodchko did, he was, in a very hand-waving way, he was able to find the analogs of such conserved quantities for this particular model. And by using the mathematical structure, he was then able to find the masses or the energies of all the quasiparticles. So the criticizing model perturbed by a longitudinal field, given this very special mathematical structure, is actually one of three canonical models, so-called off-critical conformal field theories, which have exceptional mathematical structure. So the EA is realized in this the case of the Ising chain, but there are the two models which involve some more fine-tuning, but still will be very interesting to find potential experimental realizations. And in all cases, there is a conjecture that the number of stable particles is related to the conformal charge of the quantum critical point and the so-called anomalous dimension of the perturbation. So, of course, another important issue in the system is to see the properties of the true critical point. And one expects, of course, to find gap closure only at the three-dimensional Bragg peak due to the interchain couplings. And so far, I've only shown measurements that were slightly away from that. Now, to really access the true quantum critical point is very challenging in a ferromagnet because any small field misalignment creates a longitudinal field, and that will prevent the gap from closing. How many minutes I have? 5 minutes. Oh, I see. To overcome torque effects, as I mentioned, we put the sample inside this metallic cage. And after doing that, we realized the crystal was maybe a degree off and so on. And we made another special goniometer around it to correct for that. And then we put it in the dilution fridge and looked carefully at the Bragg peaks. And what we found was that if we monitor now the vertical position of a Bragg peak in the horizontal plane, as we approach a critical field, the crystal moved. And so we attributed this to the fact that actually the dilution insert has a very weak point here, where it's just a plastic connection and it's relatively loose. So to overcome that, we then put extra spacers in here, which of course would increase slightly the base temperature, but we'll make sure that that's rigid. So you know, the system wants so much to avoid the critical point that surprisingly, you know, the whole dilution insert rotated. So by the time we've done that, and you know, we've dealt with that problem, made sure that's rigid, the dilution fridge stopped working. But anyway, we're able to do measurements at 2 Kelvin, and you know, we take what we can get. So at this temperature, then we monitor the excitations as a function of field, and this is data where I've subtracted the 9 Tesla data, so no, the elastic line is subtracted off. And as you can see, at 6 Tesla, there is a gap, 5.5, maybe a small one, but at 5, it looks like the gap has closed. So, you know, as far as we can tell here, the gap becomes very, very small, close to a critical point. And of course, we'd like to look at this at much lower temperatures as well. And we've also probed now at very high fields, the dispersions now along all three directions. This is technically very challenging because you want to apply the magnetic field perpendicular to the Ising direction, and there's only one crystallographic direction that satisfies this. And in that case, we want to apply the field vertically, but you also want to probe the dispersion vertically. And so you need an instrument which has position sensitivity, essentially, along two directions. And this is our model for the dispersion relation. It agrees very well with what's expected for spin flips hopping on a triangular lattice of coupled chains. So to summarize, if we've experimentally realized a canonical model for quantum phase transitions in the Ising chain cobalt niobate, and we've observed a key prediction of 1D Ising criticality, which is transmutation in the nature of quasiparticles from solid pairs of solitons into single spin flips. And we observed a very rich structure bound state, which in zero field matches very well with predictions of confinement of 1D gap fermions. And also close to the critical point, the bound state, we observed two bound states, that, and their ratio appears to become very close to what's predicted for the E8 model. So we attribute these two to the first two mesons of the E8 spectrum predicted for the off-criticizing chain longitudinal field. Actually, I had a completely different other topic to talk about, but there's no time, so we'll have to stop here.
Well, thanks very much, Radu. That was really wonderful. So we've got time for questions or comments from the audience, and I'd ask you to wait for the microphone. I can start with one of my own, and I almost hate to ask it because you showed such beautiful data, but I was going to ask you about data that perhaps you took and you didn't show. So when you tune the critical field, the field to the critical point, and the order parameter collapses, is there any interesting or unusual critical phenomenon associated with that that you would get out of a traditional critical analysis of the intensities and the diffuse scattering and such?
Potentially. Now, in the experiments to actually see the order parameter, it was technically very restricted because we had to do it with a horizontal field. And the wedges were all in the way, and there was a very narrow region that we could access. So essentially, to really line up the field transverse to the Ising axis, we had to rotate the north-south with respect to the crystal. Is that sensitive to actually get the critical point? So we rotated the whole magnet and then the crystal inside it the opposite way, such that the Bragg condition would be realized, but north-south would be scanning. So in principle, now that we have the technology to do it in a vertical field by scattering vertically, one should be able to look more carefully at that.
Is any unusual critical phenomenon expected, or should it be 3D Ising or this type of thing?
Now, because chains are coupled actually in a frustrated triangular geometry, the universal behavior at the through 3D critical field is non-trivial and is associated with spontaneous Ising ordering on this triangular lattice as well. And in some regimes, one expects to find a spin density wave, and in others, commensurate order and so on. So here, because the technical challenges, we've not really been able to explore this so far. But in the next system that I wanted to mention, we did actually see an incommensurate spin density wave state. That's an antiferromagnet, so alignment is not so critical. So in that case, we were able to see an incommensurate spin density wave that's stable just below the quantum critical point. That's very unusual because an incommensurate spin density wave, you know, has amplitude modulated moments, so classically is not a stable ground state at zero temperature. Always wants to become commensurate. But the quantum fluctuations close to the critical point make the order parameter very small, and so it can adjust itself to optimize JFQ at the extent of not optimizing the moment. But if you go deep enough, then you want to have a large moment, and that's okay. So in this particular case, we did see a new phase close to a critical point.
Okay, thank you. Yes, Steve.
Are there complementary measurements in the quantum critical regime of, well, thermodynamics, like specific heat or transport, the thermal conductivity or something to?
Well, that's a very good question. So there are technical challenges for this to really stop the sample from moving. So we haven't been able to overcome these technical challenges, but I'm aware that the group at Princeton is working on this. They have measurements, I think, from 500 millik upwards. So what you would expect to find close to the critical point is, so if you are at the critical point, then you expect to find a linear contribution in the specific heat. I think they're just at the edge where that could just about be seen. So I would expect that they will pursue that further and probably find a temperature range where it's 3D physics, and then linear regime, and then you know, at the temperature that's comparable to J, then you've lost this universal physics.
Well, what about transport? Because I mean, I agree with you. You know what to expect in terms of the specific heat, but the transport is quite a critical regime, sort of a more vexed problem theoretically.
Yeah. So you know that I think will be very interesting to explore experimentally. Now there would certainly be some aspects to think about in the sense that because of the 3D couplings, fundamentally at the lowest, very lowest energies, the system knows it's 3D. So you have to find the right temperature scale or energy scale that's above the 3D couplings, but still where the 1D dispersion would be linear. And so the purpose of our experiment to characterize the 3D dispersion relation was basically to provide a microscopic picture of that. And with that understanding, then you could analyze transport data and so on. I think if you just took the transport data and wanted to analyze that, it would really be very hard to do quantitative modeling. But quantifying this would provide quantitative predictions for where the theory should be applicable. We find from this that interchain couplings are of the order 1-2%. So that is really a limit where you would expect to find some range. So one other way we're pursuing this is to look at the thermal broadening the lifetime of excitations upon putting temperature in. And so, of course, if this was a pure 1D chain, then at the critical point, you'd expect some broadening that increases linearly with temperature. So if some plot, say, if you had gamma as a function of temperature, you'd expect linear behavior and then some saturation where the temperature was comparable to J. Now, of course, here we have a 3D scale that we have to overcome. So then one would expect to find a narrow temperature range for 3D physics, then 1D physics, then lattice effects. And so we're now in the process of, we've collected some data and we're in the process of analyzing it at the critical point and at a few section of fields above that, where we tuned the gap. That's the sort of thing that I think we might find. That's what we're looking for, certainly.
Okay, further questions or comments? Yes, Michelle.
You mentioned at the beginning that the lithium holmium fluorine was one of the archetypes for transversalizing quantum criticality. And there, I think what is found is that when you get close to the would be the electronic quantum critical point,
yeah,
the hyperfine interaction comes in and shortcut the this quantum criticality. So do you have any kind of physics like that here that may actually show up at low energy and just cut off the quantum criticality? The hyperfine interactions here, yeah, would be way smaller than...
I think it's way smaller here, yeah. I think it's way smaller.
So what about...
If you were to look at the 1 micron, one micro EV scale, potentially, but I think...
What about magnetoelastic effects?
Yeah, we've not looked into that. At any magnetic phase transition, the electrometry would show some change. But if it's 10 to the minus 9 effect, whether it's relevant or not, I don't really. The reason this is much closer, the evidence we have In this system, you can get much closer to the critical point than in lithium holmium fluoride, is that the minimal gap compared to the full bandwidth is much, much narrower. Okay, so I don't remember the details with this 3D system, but I think the gap actually was quite comparable to the bandwidth. Whereas here, you know, if there is any gap, you know, it would be below 0.2 MeV, and the bandwidth of high energies is like 4 MeV. So, you know, 0.2 to 4 is relatively small, I would say.
Okay, further questions? Then if not, let's thank Radu for a very beautiful talk.